Hi, Shirley.
Hi, Joel. Thank you much for having me.
I'm very stoked. I'm so excited to talk to you. We're going to talk about data visualization. That's kind of your thing. It's what you're known for. But I wanted to first start out and talk to you about how you work, because you know, over the last 3 or 4 years, you took the switch from being an employee, a full-time employee, mm-hmm. to being a freelancer, to working for yourself. And I was wondering, what caused you to make that decision, make that leap into this world of freelance work?
Yeah, so I have to say that I actually never expected to freelance, yeah. in the sense that I've always been extremely risk averse, like don't even want to do stocks. That's how risk averse I am. And so I always thought of freelancing as something that like was way too scary not to have that regular paycheck. Mm-hmm. But then when I was about 24 and I was working my first year at a startup, and I was realizing that I was working nights and weekends, I wasn't having much else of a life. And that's when I started doing more and more side projects. And then in 2 years later, I was kind of trying to figure out my next step. And that kind of realization I had at 24 kept on sticking with me. And I had a few friends in data visualization that were also freelancing at that time. And they kind of were like super amazing about explaining the whole process to me, being like, hey, there is risk, but here's how you kind of like go and set up all the legal process and all the financial process and accounting so that you don't have all of that risk. And I was like, oh, maybe this is something I can try. Maybe this is something I can try and figure out what it is that I really enjoy doing, because I knew I enjoyed doing data visualization, but I didn't know what industry I liked it to be in. So I was like, oh, maybe I'll go freelance for like a year or two, and figure out what it is that I want to do with my life and like go back into full-time when I figured it out. 3 years later, I'm like, nope, I like it here.
Yeah, sticking with it.
Working for myself.
What's the best part about being a freelancer?
The freedom. What I did not realize about myself until I quit is how much I actually hated being told what to do.
Yeah, I feel that.
And I mean, like, I did it. Like, I was like, oh, this is what a full-time job is. Like, you know, I get told what to do by managers and my bosses. And once I became my own boss, I was like, oh, I can take on whatever clients I want to, and I don't have to take on clients and projects I don't want to. I can do podcast recordings if I want. I can travel to conferences if I want. I can do whatever I want. And that freedom is really amazing. So that is my favorite thing.
Yeah, recently you took like months off to go do a fellowship at NYU, right? Like you were able to do that, and that's not necessarily something you could do if you're working as a salaried employee. I mean, you could probably there might be a company that would accept that, but you know, like that's unusual and something you have the freedom to do.
Yeah, and that's like you're right. Like a company might accept it, but only if I've worked there for like, you know, 3, 4, 5 years, like proven myself as like a
sabbatical
working employee. Yeah, like a sabbatical sort of thing. Like they would probably let me do like 3 months or something like that. But yeah, being freelancing, being free meant that I was like, okay, this is kind of something I want for the next step of my career. Like when I kind of really looked back at what I wanted to do next, I was like, oh, I want to do more art kind of things next. And went to NYU, went to ITP for 3 months. And that was really amazing. Very bad financial decision, but extremely worth it for everything else.
I think like going to New York in general is just a bad financial decision for almost anybody. But
oh yeah, and I was paying rent in Brooklyn and mortgage in SF.
Oh yeah, nice. Double duty.
Oh yeah.
So what's the worst part about being a freelancer? What's maybe not the worst part, but what's, you know, like what are the drawbacks of this type of work?
I think there's two things that are really hard for me. The first is just the amount of stress of worrying about money. And I think it's especially really hard being in San Francisco and being consistently surrounded by the knowledge that I could be making more at a full-time mm-hmm. job. And I think that part is really hard. And I find that I actually talked about this in Kent's podcast, actually, where he asked me what was something that I really disliked. And I think one of the things I really dislike is I can't help but think about like potential projects and potential clients as the monetary figure. Like, oh, like if I take on this project, then I would, because this one's smaller, so I have to take on another project or something like that. And that I really don't like having to think that way, of always having to think about the money. And I just wish I could be like, oh, this client is a really great client. I just really want to work with them. Or I had to recently turn down a client I was extremely excited about because they just didn't have the budget. But yeah, for me, the first part is kind of always being stressed about the money. And the second part, I think, is very related, which is because I'm a freelancer and there's like a actual value to my hour and daily rate, it means that if I don't check myself, I end up just constantly working and I don't have a good balance and I don't give enough time like with my family or friends or like my husband, and I fall really easily into a rabbit hole of just like working because I'm like, oh, if I just work another day, that's like,
because it's money. A service, right? Like you're providing a service. Yeah. and that service is you and your time and your, yeah, your billing rate, right? Like
yeah,
I don't know, I would always find myself when I was freelancing applying my hourly rate to non-work things, like, oh yeah, well, I could be making, you know, $150 an hour right now, but instead I'm having a burrito. I don't think so.
Or conversely, I'm just like a horrible person where I'm like, oh, I can buy this thing and it's only like X number of hours of my time.
Yeah, that new thing costs, you know, that's 3 hours of work or 2 hours of work. And
I'm like, oh, it's okay then, because it's not actually that much of my hourly rate.
So. I think it's true. Like it's not much different in that regard to me than working a full-time job, right? Like you still are providing a service, but you just like, it gives you a different mindset in terms of how you're viewing kind of the value of your time. I'm curious, like, do you bill on an hourly basis or a daily basis or weekly basis? How do you approach projects like that from a billing perspective?
I actually haven't done a client project in a while because I had the fellowship thing. So this is now like a review for me.
I'll get back into it.
Yeah, I need to get back into it. So I bill daily. And this is after I tried a couple different ways. First, I tried to bill hourly. And that was really bad because it was really stressful being like, okay, now I need to turn off the clock to go eat lunch and I need to turn off the clock to like go to the bathroom. And so I tried by project, and that was also really bad because I like projects inevitably like balloon in scope or in time. And so now I just do it by daily, and then I give my clients a rough project estimate and I say any extra days are an additional charge.
Yeah. How do you find new clients? Where is your work coming from? And like you said, you're getting back into it, so this is probably on your mind even. Like where are they coming from? Is it something you seek, or are they seeking you out, or where are your leads coming from?
Yeah. So for most of my freelancing, I've been really lucky in that they've always found me just because of what I've put out there, like on the internet, with my projects or with the conference talks I do. I think the conference talks actually help a lot because it leads to like very eventual clients, not immediate, but like people will remember, that's what she does. And then when they have a project, they'll think of me. So most of my leads have been because of putting my work out there and they find me. So I've been lucky in that way. I used to be picky about the projects I take in that I always wanted it to have something like that's an interesting technical challenge or like an interesting topic. But in the past year, I've been really trying to figure out like what it is that I want to be, like what kind of projects do I want to be working on that are meaningful to me. And so I found that I've become even more picky, unfortunately. And so now I'm trying to figure out how to pitch potential clients that I'm really interested in working on. It's a very mixed result because it's very hard to pitch someone that has never thought about data visualization in hasn't made any budget for it, that they might need what I want to do for them.
That's interesting though, because it's kind of flipping it on its head, because you'd find, you know, whatever the subject matter, people would find you and they would have, you know, some result. But instead you are seeing potential projects in spaces that you are interested in, that you feel passionate about, and pitching your services to them. So it's kind of it's putting you in a more of a sales role in some ways.
And that's something that I've been really struggling with, because I think, and this is something else that I realized recently, which is that I really can't do all this by myself anymore. Because I think when I was able to do things with clients coming in, it meant that I was spending still most of my time working on the projects, and thus have working on billable hours. And you know, there's like all these overhead, but it wasn't so bad. It was maybe like 30% of my time to like talk with potential clients, or do the contracts or do the billing. And maybe it was like 30-40% of my time, which is kind of large, but it's doable. And now that I'm seeing projects I want to work on, organizations I want to work with, and I have to kind of like figure out a pitch for them, it's a lot of time, and I don't think I can, and that's what I'm trying to figure out for the new year, of really figuring out maybe like a person that I can really work with for that sales part.
Like the almost like an agent or a salesperson, or just somebody to collaborate with to handle and take some of that burden off, so you can think about, you know, kind of the core problems that you're interested in, and let somebody that's good at that stuff and handle that.
Yeah I just want to do the creative things.
Yeah, it'd be nice. Like I feel you there. Like I just want to tinker with code all day, and then you end up you know, like there's all this other stuff that you end up needing to do just to manage a business. And I feel like, you know, like freelancing, it puts all this administrative burden on yourself now, right? Like if you're working for a company, they kind of handle a lot of the administration for you and the paperwork and this, that, and the other. But now you're responsible for it. So not only are you dealing with clients and all this stuff, you end up with, you know, like dealing with state and local and federal taxes fun stuff. So it's a give and take. Like I think the freedom is ultimately worth it for a lot of people, but at the same time, you know, it's like, are you, you know, can you take this and can you handle it? I think 3 years in or 4 years in now, almost, like you, like obviously it's setting well with you. You didn't give up your experiment.
No. In fact, I like doubled down on it.
Yeah. Well, that's what you got to do. Like I guess it's working out. So now I need to just go full force. That makes sense. I want to take it back. I want to take it way back. And I want to know like how you got into like programming computers and technology in general. Like where did this start for you?
Oh wow. If we take it way, way back.
Yeah, all the way.
I think when I was 10, I was like, I'm going to be a Pixar animator.
I guess
that's the way, way back.
I went to college for that, actually. Like that's what my degree is in. I didn't make it to Pixar, but that was the goal at the time. It was like right when Toy Story came out, and I wanted to be a Pixar animator. So I studied 3D graphics.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
Do you still do that?
No, I ended up doing, I did forensic animation, like Death on the Highway car crash stuff for about 13 years. And then, you know, I switched to programming because the salary ceiling for that particular career is pretty low. So yeah. So anyway, you want to be a Pixar animator.
Oh, yes. So I think when I was like 10, and I, you know, at that time, like, I don't even know what that means or like what that requires. And then I went to middle school, went to high school. Was on the back of my mind. My high school didn't offer any computer science classes, so I couldn't kind of take that. In high school, I guess I can admit this now because it's like a decade later or something. So in high school, I think around my freshman year, my first experience with tech was, I think, in middle school, because we took like a computer, like a typing class, but that taught a little bit of basic web design. And because of that, I started designing websites. And my first ever website for myself was freshman year. And I designed a whole website where I would go into IRC and download manga. And then I would upload it to my website and manage it.
Nice. So you're running a pirate manga site. Is that what's going on?
It was Yeah, that was my very first website. And I did the HTML and CSS, and I was too scared of the JavaScript part because I had like nobody around me coded or anything. So I had like nobody to ask for help. Google wasn't a thing. And so I just did the HTML and CSS, and yeah, I helped redistribute manga from questionably acquired sources.
You're doing a public service. Like you're hooking people up.
I learned a lot.
So how did that lead you into being a data visualization expert? What's the leap there? How'd you cross that chasm?
Actually, that was like the first time I like quote unquote publicly admitted that I used to redistribute manga. No, it has absolutely nothing to do with each other, I think. Although I think that that interest in web and web design led me to take a web design mini class in college. And mm-hmm. I think that's what ultimately led me to my first job. So I think that was when my first job was as a front-end developer at a big data company. And that was my first year was when D3 was just released, and they just wanted someone to look at it. And so that's how I got into D3, and that's how I was introduced to data visualization. And I didn't even know that that was a thing that existed. And that's the kind of thin connection between those two.
Yeah. I think it's great though. Like just that introduction, it's like, oh, well, I want to put something out there. I love this stuff. And I'm, you know, like you have the fandom and the desire to like share it with others. So you use the tools that you have available to get it out there. I mean, that's really great.
Thank you.
So what is data visualization? Like how do you define it, or how do you explain it to people? What's the elevator pitch for data visualization?
Oh, I don't have a good elevator pitch. I'm just like, it's when you take lots of data and, you know, especially if there's thousands of rows and it's hard for you to just look in Excel and you visualize that into some sort of graph or chart. The most simple could be a bar chart or a, I only condone pie charts in very specific use cases, but some sort of a graph so that you can understand trends within it easier. So I think that's my kind of simplified version of explanation of data visualization.
And how did you get into it? You said you left college, you started as a front end developer. You were at a company that dealt with a lot of data and they wanted you to look at D3. So what did that like what kind of work were you doing there? And then how did that lead to what you're doing today?
Yeah. So I think I came into data visualization in a rather untraditional way, but considering how new data visualization is, I think most of us come into it in an like untraditional way. In that, I started because I think my company just wanted to like build some sort of like a tree, an XML tree into their product, so people could, I think, edit some sort of an application that they were doing. And so they needed D3 for that. And once I grasped D3, I was like, oh, this is super fun. Mm-hmm. And I got really into it, and I started doing more and more things with D3 and trying to explore more of the library. And then at a certain point, I got involved with Bay Area D3 User Group, which is the meetup group here for D3. And that's when I started meeting other people that were doing similar things, because D3, you know, at that time, and still now, it was such a niche thing that I couldn't find anybody else at my own company to talk about with. So I found this kind of community, and it was like a really great support group sort of thing. And then that's where I learned that there's so much more to data visualization, that first of all, that what I was doing was called data visualization. And second of all, that there's so much more to data visualization. And so what I was doing was just the code part, and it was specifically coding for the web. But there's also the design part and the data analysis part and a whole industry of data journalism that's about storytelling. So I think that's kind of how I really got into this whole thing of data visualization, of being first introduced to such a small part and then realizing that there's like a whole world of it. And it it particularly kind of stuck with me because I've always loved math in school. I've always loved working with numbers. I loved to code just because I loved the feeling of creating something. And it makes so much sense to me. The logical part of it just makes a lot of sense to me. And I actually grew up painting for 14 years, and I gave that up in university. And so I loved the fact that visualization had an artistic design sort of aspect to it.
That was going to be my next question, actually, because I get the, you know, the fundamental kind of like, here's some data, we need to look at it. But then like the quality almost, you know, it's like you got to like draw some sort of balance between the art and the data and the usefulness of what you're presenting to people.
Yeah. And I think that balance is sometimes really hard, but I think it's, well, okay. So there's what I try to do now, which is that to balance the telling the data or telling the story that's informed by the data versus kind of the more artistic thing. I think there's always a tension of like, how artistic do you go or how creative do you go so that it catches people's attention versus how much do you restrain that so that it's, you know, easy for people to get what you're trying to say right away. And I think there's always a tension there. And I don't think it's a one or the other. I think it's a spectrum. And I think it really depends on what you're trying to do with the piece. So, you know, if you're the New York Times and you're trying to like convince or not convince, but you're trying to tell a story to an audience, like maybe you don't want something that's like super flashy, but then maybe I always love Georgia Lupi's work. And she's a data designer in New York City. And she recently released a fashion line around data about three women, about Ada Lovelace, Meg Jensen, and Rachel Carson. And her work is always so much more on the art side. And it's extremely beautiful, and it takes a lot of time for you to kind of go through and understand the underlying data just because she encodes so much. It always takes like an hour for me to like decode it all. But for her, especially for that fashion line, her purpose is art, her purpose is fashion. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I think there is a spectrum in which you can slide back and forth. But I think these days, to me, like how I decide where in that spectrum is always like, what do I want for the end user to experience? Whereas before, when I was, you know, just coding and I hadn't thought about the design part like years ago, I used to just be like, I'm gonna just do this for the technical fun of it.
Yeah, I mean, I suspect sometimes you want, you know, like if I'm doing, you know, some sort of high frequency trading stock dashboard, yeah, like the point is, I want to look at it and I want to know what's going on right now.
Yeah.
But with a project like you're talking about George's work, where it's more artistic, the data is still there. You want people to figure it out, but you want them to spend time and almost marinate in the data and feel what's going on versus, you know, like instant information. So that's, you know, there's a huge spectrum in between that as well.
Yeah. And the beauty for her, the beauty is number one thing. And for me, I think I lean more towards the, like, I like projects where the beauty is the main thing.
I think you, regardless, right? Like people, it needs to be aesthetically pleasing. Even if you are talking about a high frequency trading dashboard, people want to look at that. And, you know, if you have to stare at this thing all day, it needs to look good, right? Like you can't just have, you know, some sort of bootstrap looking graph. Like, I guess you can. It depends on the use case. I'm not
gonna, I think people are extremely tolerant when they have to do something and that's their only option. I think people are extremely tolerant.
Yeah, they'll take what they can get. They'll just, that's fine. It works for now. So what do you tell people? I have to imagine people ask you like, how do I get into this? How do I, you know, get into data visualization and do this on the job? What's your advice and where do you suggest they start?
Oh, yeah. And so actually, in the last year, it's great because I now have a very easy answer to this question, which is there is now an organization called Data Visualization Society. Okay. And it's got like 10,000 members and a very active Slack with like a lot of different channels that discuss different things that are, and they also kind of try to collect resources for beginners to tell them where to start. And so they've actually made my job really easy. So I just tell people to go to DataViz Society, and I'm sure they'll be able to find their way from there. But what I used to say is I used to ask people like, okay, like what is, even like when you say I want to get into data visualization, like data visualization has like, I think of it as multiple different parts. And mm-hmm. so that those parts are like data analysis that feeds in, and there's the information design, there's the coding on the web, or you know, coding I think with like Tableau or any of the other software that's out there. And there's also the storytelling aspect of it. It's a very wide range that kind of all feeds into data visualization. And so the first question I always ask is like, what is your background? Are you already a developer? Are you already a designer? Are you already one of those things, or are you coming in completely new? And the second question I ask is like, given that background, like what is an area that you want to concentrate on first? Because it would be very hard for you to try and tackle all of it first. Right. And so what is the area that you want to get better at first? And I usually actually, for most people, I suggest that they try working on the design part first, the information design part first, because I think that's the most important thing in making sure that a person creates visualizations that are good.
Yeah. If you don't, because information design is the underlying data, right? Like, would that be correct? Like, we need to take some raw data and create something useful, and that it, otherwise you'll never get to where you want to be. Like, you might, you know, your end result isn't going to be good.
Yeah. It's kind of the whole study of like, you know, if given this sort of data, like what sort of graph should we apply it, or like feed it into, or like, how do we design this thing such that it makes the most sense to people, or like even just questioning what the purpose of the visualization is. It's kind of the whole design approach, but with a more specific information, kind of information visualization lens to it. And so I usually suggest people to go there. And then from there, like, either if they don't want to code, then like maybe they can try out some of the like software that's kind of feed your data in and choose your graph options or choose different options, and then they can try and cut out the code that way. Or if they do want to code, then there's like, here's the list of workshops that are out there, or like online resources. And if you want to do the data part, like here's this list of resources. So that's the longer answer to how do I get started with data visualization.
I mean, on some levels, you could open Excel and drop your data in there and start playing with, you know, there's charts and graphs in Excel. And at that point, you are visualizing data.
Yeah.
And it might not be the artistic expression or really have the ultimate end meaning, but that's, you know, we can start exploring, and we can start exploring data visualization at that level.
Yeah, you're right. I always forget Excel.
I think a lot of us do, especially like if you've been coding a long time, you forget that Excel exists, which is probably like the number one coding environment on the planet, because lots of people that aren't programmers use Excel and do these kinds of things on a daily basis. And it is a programming environment, but you know, like
you're absolutely right. I make the mistake of just trying to use code as like my big hammer solution to everything. And I'm trying to get better at that.
Yeah. You and me both. I love it.
and then I follow up and tell them like, once you feel like you got a good fundamentals, then try and figure out a small bite-sized chunk project that you can do, that you can like kind of apply all those skills to, and then go from there. So that's the end part of the answer to the question.
You see, and just like related to that, when people want to learn something or they're trying something new, whether it's data visualization or programming mm-hmm. computers in general, do people try to attack projects that are maybe too big or too ambitious when we could, you know, like maybe achieve something if we had a smaller scope?
Yeah, I think so. And I think it's especially easy to do that with data visualization, I think, because I think if you've never worked on a data viz project, I think it's hard to grasp all the components that might go into it. Maybe someone could be like, especially if they're trying to learn, the code part, especially, they might be like, oh, that like bar graph looks really easy to code or something. And then like 5 hours in D3 later, they're like, why? Yeah. This is so complicated. And so I think there is a tendency to get too ambitious, because I think people think, like, especially with the data viz environment now, having flourished quite a bit with like really beautiful examples out there, people might be like, oh, if mine doesn't look like that, then it's not worth undertaking. But no, like, start small, start like, just have that backlog of very small projects that you might never publish because you're not proud of it. But then that's how it gets to the projects that you do feel proud of that are bigger that you can publish. I have a lot of projects that I don't ever want to publish.
Yeah. Do you think there's room for how much room in the industry is there for more data visualization specialists?
Oh, I think, so I was listening to a podcast that was a year in review kind of roundup of DataViz. And the podcast is called Data Stories. It's a very like long running podcast in data visualization. And I think, the general excitement is that the community feels like it's finally starting to get more mainstream recognition as a kind of that data visualization isn't just kind of like a skill that's tacked on, but might actually be a whole job function. And so I think it's probably getting quite exciting.
So expanding versus contracting, there's going to be more opportunities. It's viable. It's a viable career becoming more viable.
Yeah, but I think I'm probably biased and they're probably biased because we're in the community hope that that's. But I think there's a lot of factors pointing to the fact that it's probably more expanding.
I think something you said with the DataViz Society, right? Like there's this whole group that's come out to help people learn and grow. And like, to me, that's a very positive indicator in terms of a specialty. If you see, you know, communities sprouting up around a certain topic, then there's more assurance there, to me anyway, that there's probably more opportunities, right?
And it's grown to 10,000 members in less than a year. So I think there really is like a need and a want for it.
How does data visualization relate to like generative art and are they related, and is, you know, like generative art an interesting path into data visualization?
So I think it's very similar, and I think, and I don't do generative art, so I don't want to be like,
I don't know. I'd argue, I've seen some of your stuff. It looks pretty artistic and generative, but it's not random. I think that's the difference, right? Like you're taking data sets versus like this idea that we're just going to go random.
Yeah, so that is the number one difference in my head, that, I actually think of it as three separate things. I think there's data visualization, data art, and then generative art. So data visualization is where you, there's a goal to it. Like you're taking data and you're trying to communicate something, or you're trying to build a tool to help people explore that data. So there is a goal, and I think the community usually is much more strict about it. They might be like, you shouldn't be using like this thing here. But then data art is when you take a data set and you're just creating something like aesthetically pleasing that you just are trying to enjoy. And I like that one just because I feel like there isn't as much like of an expectation there. And then generative art is in my head when it's randomly generated and doesn't have any data tied to it.
And more purely aesthetic, maybe.
And very beautiful. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, some of it is, but you know, so what are you currently working on? What's your tech stack, and what do you like working with?
So, let me answer what am I currently working with? I'm in this, with this turn of the new year, I'm in this weird place of, I have to confess, I've always kind of felt really weird being put in a box of being like, oh, you do data visualization. Like of being like, oh, Shirley equals data visualization.
Like a label, right? Like a label. Like a strict label. This is what I do. Oh, yeah. I'm a data visualization professional.
Yeah. And I understand that it helps people kind of like put the world into order, but it like really makes me kind of,
it's limiting.
Unhappy. Yeah. And so I think, what I want to go do more in the future is it involves data, it involves code, it involves visualizing data, but I want to and it involves, I think I want to do more art, but I want to What I did at NYU was physical data installation. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I'm most obsessed with right now is trying to figure out how I can take the visualizations that I do in the browser and bring it out into the real world and kind of like expand it into the real world all around us and like have it be able to immerse us so that we can feel more of a connection to that data set and more of a connection to that story. I've just been kind of frustrated with how little retention there might be if you're just, you know, scrolling through a story, even if it's beautifully done, even if the data set is like amazing, inspirational, the story is great. I think there's the impact it could have is not as good as like in a screen as if you could walk through it and like interact with it with your whole body. And that's the thing I'm really excited about right now. And I don't know if that's data visualization.
It could be. Yeah. Like I see that. And, you know, it's like there's the physical, there's all, we have, you know, five senses, right? And mm-hmm. when we're looking at a screen, we're really engaging our eyes and our scroll finger. And even something, you know, like I love like the pudding, right? Like I love those stories and I go through them and then you're doing that. But what if, you know, what if I can be immersed in that? And what if I can, and I've seen a lot of these, interactive kind of creative spaces, whether they're in museums or, mm-hmm. You know, projects popping up and more of that. I think, you know, like there's augmented reality and virtual reality and then the actual physically being there and being able to touch this and interact with it, I think is powerful. And has a lot of potential. Are you working on something right now, or how far into that space have you explored?
I'm taking baby steps in. Mm-hmm. I just finished something at ITP for my fellowship. And we're kind of doing the write up for that right now, and we're trying to kind of plan the launch of that right now. And it's very interesting, kind of before like quote unquote launching a project. For me, it would just be like posting the link and it's just a website and people can go mm-hmm. to it. But now it's like we have to edit all the footage and
the whole thing.
It was showcased at the ITP winter show, and it was extremely well received. And so we want to kind of start pitching it to like festivals or like kind of the creative coding festivals mm-hmm. or pitching it to some of the like art and technology organizations and seeing if there would be people interested in like sponsoring it for kind of like a more refined version too. And so that's where I'm at. And I think I still want to create data visualizations, but I want to expand also into this world of trying to tell stories that are meaningful to me and hopefully meaningful to a lot of others in kind of a immersive space. So that's my goal for the next
I look forward to seeing that seeing what you can come up with. That'll be exciting. And I love that. Like I love the idea of being more interactive and being more immersed. I feel like you're right on the money in terms of what sticks with you, right? Like if we engage all five of our senses, what can we come away with versus something that we just see and scroll through and maybe click away or whatever. I think that's interesting.
And I really liked what you were saying about, there's a lot of things happening now at museums and stuff where it's like that you can experience with your whole being. But I feel like with a lot of those, I think the opportunity for me personally is that for a lot of those, it's not yet data driven. Like the story might not be as clear. Like maybe it's for the aesthetic of it, or a lot of places are like it's for the Instagram or but I really want to put in that kind of like meaningful data set. I don't know. Yeah.
Did you happen to check out Zero Space when you were in New York?
No.
Have you seen Zero Space? It's they bill it as an immersive art playground, and they kind of took over a big old building. Joshua Davis had a lot to do with it, and just like, but it's more of a psychedelic, you know, kind of immersion, like an artistic expression versus a data expression. And to me, like if you combine something like that with like knowledge and I don't know, you know, like the actual data and teaching along with the kind of entertainment value of the arts and kind of the immersive experience. I think there's a lot of room in that particular space.
Yeah, that's the hope. And I'm hoping to, the other thing I want to figure out this year is trying to figure out how to expand beyond just myself and working with more people for like these bigger production sort of things.
Yeah, that's interesting too. And it's funny because it goes back to freelance, right? Like where you are, you're kind of this lone gun and you're out there and you have to do everything versus having a team. And that's one of the things that like for me, it gets lonely sometimes to me to be a freelancer and you're working for people and with people, but you don't have this consistent team where you have the same vision over multiple years. Like we've built that over the last few years at Egghead and it's been really nice, you know, to have this consistent group of people and you do things and expand on what you know and kind of have a shared vision and outcome, and that's been really good too. But you know, then it brings all sorts of, like, you have a bunch of people's interests and there's all sorts of give and take there too, I feel like.
Yeah.
So are you using Vue? Is that what you use these days?
Yes, my technical stack is D3 is the one that's consistent. Mm-hmm. I'm now using Vue for kind of my framework, the entire web framework. I'm using GreenSock for animations.
That's awesome.
And I use GreenSock when I have to do those, like, we call it scrolly telling, when like the visualization changes based on your scroll. Mm-hmm. And so for that, I use GreenSock and this website called Scrollama, which is by Russell from The Pudding. Scrollama.js. And so I use those two together. And so my tech stack usually, it's all front end, but it's usually, or for the front end part of it is usually Vue, D3, GreenSock, Scrollama if I need it, and Lodash.
Are you a big explorer of technologies? Like when a new framework drops, do you have to get in there and try it out as quickly as possible?
Oh, no. I'm a very late adopter to things. It took me like a year and like half a year of people telling me like, hey Shirley, you should really, really check out Vue, for me to, I think maybe like a year, for me to be like, okay, I'll check out Vue. No, I like to kind of like get to know something and like to pick something and then really get to know it and get very deep with it, just because I think I'm actually a very slow learner. And so for me to learn something new, I have to like really put in and invest that time. But because of that, I tend to then understand something quite deeply. And so I don't explore new things very often. Although when I do see things I think would be really helpful for what I do, I do try and go learn it. So I went and learned 3JS and WebGL so that I can think in 3D space, so that I can start thinking about like how to think in the physical world. And then at NYU, I audited like physical computation. So that was like Arduinos and sensors and whatever I need for my goal is what I go learn. But I'm too slow to be able to be like, every new thing that comes out, I'm going to go try it.
Yeah. So what do you love about Vue? What hooked you and caused you to make that choice? If you're making these reasoned, responsible decisions, and I totally approve of that. Like I really think that's the, like, become an expert, like really, you know, like if you have your general career figured out, you know, like specialization and using the tools that you know is really a quite a good thing. But I'm curious about what it is you love about Vue and what keeps you sticking with that tool.
Because we first met at React Rally, huh?
We did.
I still really love that community.
Yeah, me too.
But the thing that got me to switch from React to Vue was really two main reasons. And it's really because, and those two reasons are both because I think it plays much more nicely with D3 and what I need to do with data visualizations. And so the first reason is because of their reactivity system. I haven't looked at React since, I think, March of 2018. So I'm sure like React changes all the time. So like maybe they already have this, but with Vue's reactivity system, when I first looked at it, it just made a lot of sense to me because it meant that every time a user like manipulated the data, the underlying data, or edited it, I don't need to go and write anything to like hook that up and I can just like listen for those changes in the templates. Like if I just tell it, like, I want this SVG element to like use this data, I don't have to then be like, okay, when this data changes, like update it. It would just automatically update it for me. And so from that perspective, it saves me a lot of code, lines of code. Mm-hmm. Just because having a system that helps me manage those data updates and makes it as easy as possible for me is like a huge thing for when I'm doing data visualization. And the second reason is because Vue, unlike React at the time, Vue treats animations as a like first class citizen. I don't know if that's because Sarah's on the core team, but it has such good GreenSock support. And even without GreenSock, it's like very much built in. And so again, with data visualizations, animations is huge. And so having that support in Vue just made things so much easier. Whereas like before with React, I really had to fight React for like for any of my visualizations to do any sort of animations.
Yeah, so Vue works it's just friendlier for data visualization and your workflows that you're doing and D3 and the entire stack of tools that you're using right now to do what you do. It just makes it easier. That makes sense. Why is D3, why does it have this reputation as being so challenging? Like what's the deal and why are people scared of D3? Like what and should they be?
I'm
not scared of it, like, you know, it doesn't literally cause fear, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, I get what you mean. And I've had like brilliant programmers tell me that they're scared of D3. And I think for me, I got into D3 before I knew any other JavaScript libraries. And okay. So I was like, oh, I guess this must be how things work.
I think they call it Stockholm syndrome. I don't know. No.
Yeah. And I didn't know that that's how things work. But I think that's precisely where the challenge of it is that it's structured. The way that you have to think about D3 is so different from a lot of the other JavaScript libraries out there that people have already become so familiar with. Mm-hmm. And I really think it's that kind of like mental shift that you have to do. I think that's the challenging part. But other than that, I think once you, there's a learning curve at the very beginning where you have to get over the mental kind of like gymnastics that is the core like enter, update, exit pattern. And then after that, a lot of things, and basically there, I think selection and data binding, that core kind of part. And then after that, everything else in the library, most of them make a lot of sense. But I've also been teaching D3 as like if you're already a front-end developer, if you're already familiar with React or Vue, the way D3's enter, update, exit pattern works is essentially how Vue and React, and like not in implementation, but like in conceptually how it's working underneath the hood. So if you replace that part where I think a lot of programmers find a little bit challenging in D3, the selection, data binding, enter, update, exit, if you replace that with Vue or React, D3 actually gets very easy to work with because D3 is very largely modular. And so you can then think of D3 as your tool to help you kind of like calculate like what, like when you take data and you want to calculate that into a tree layout or like a force diagram or something, you can just pick and choose the parts of the D3 library you need and just use that.
So you're using like an engine and you're feeding it data and getting some sort of transformed data back that you can use with Vue or React or whatever to present that data. So it's not necessarily the presentation layer. Is that fair?
Yeah.
Is this true that maybe people also have used D3 in the past and haven't used it like what I'll say modern D3, right? Like we're, because it's improved over the years, right? Like version 4 like it was a huge improvement over 3 API wise and just like in terms of learning it and the community's grown over the years.
Oh yeah, I think there was definitely a bit more, but I think the core concepts have remained the same over version 3, 4. 3 to 4 was a really big step, but even then, I think the core parts of it have remained the same, or have remained similar. There was like one big change there, but I think, yeah, I think now it's like much, it's probably much friendlier to get into.
It felt friendlier. That was the word that I had in my head, actually, was that it just feels friendlier. And I don't know if that's, you know, like the community reaching a tipping point, critical mass, documentation, mm-hmm. tutorials, you know, courses, yeah. There's all this books, there's all this stuff that's come out over the years. So now, you know, if you came into it earlier, like years ago, and they're, oh no, that's not for me, maybe now's the time to come back and give it another try. Yeah. I'm going to plug your courses because you have some very excellent courses on front end masters. And I think
you didn't
mention that. And when I asked where should people go to learn data visualization, your courses are actually a really good spot to do that.
Thank you so much.
Masters are several of them. Totally worth your time to watch that if you're interested in these topics and want to learn more directly from Shirley. Shirley, thank you so much. I really appreciate you taking the time out of your day to have this conversation. And I look forward to talking to you soon.
Definitely. Thank you so much, Joel.